Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa.
Oh, thank you very much.
Okay, this evening we will begin a new sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is the Maha Sakaludayi Sutta. The greater, actually the longer discourse to Sakaludayi. And the beginning part of this discourse will give us some understanding of what we might call the religious or spiritual scene in northern India in the time of the Buddha, while the second half of the discourse is a kind of compendium of many of the practical trainings in early Buddhism. And so the sutta serves several useful purposes. Okay, and so this sutta begins when the Buddha was living in Rajagaha in the bamboo grove. Rajagaha was the capital city of the central Indian state of Magadha. Magadha was the major state in northeast India in the time of the Buddha. And in time, Magadha was to become the center of the first Indian empire. Its power was expanding, and in time it was absorbing the smaller republics into its own territory, and in time it would embark upon campaigns of expansion, conquering other territories, until it turned into a major empire, the empire of King Ashoka. And at this time, the capital was at Rajagaha. When Magadha became an empire, the capital shifted to the city of Pataliputra. Okay, and when the discourse opens, a number of well-known wanderers, these were wandering religious teachers, were staying in a place called the Peacock Sanctuary. Apparently it's a grove or park where peacocks would dwell. And also these wandering ascetics would come here to stay as they would be traveling through the country when they came to Rajagaha. And actually, Rajagaha still exists in India under the name Rajgir. And many of the places, like the Bamboo Grove, the Vulture's Peak, still exist. They're still preserved as monuments. Okay, so when these wanderers would come to Rajagaha in the course of their wanderings, then they would go to spend the nights at the Peacock Sanctuary. And so one morning, the Buddha, as usual, would dress, takes his bowl and robe, and starts to go into Rajagaha for alms. But he reaches Rajagaha a little bit too early. Probably he realizes that people have not yet had a chance to prepare their food. And so he decides, instead of going on alms route right now, to go to the Peacock Sanctuary, the Wanderer's Park. And when he arrives at the Wanderer's Park, the wanderer named Sakaludayi is seated with a large assembly of wanderers, apparently this is his own company of disciples. And here they are, according to the account in the discourse, making an uproar, loudly and noisily talking many kinds of pointless talk, such as talk of kings. I'll come to this list of topics. But here I have to say, this is one tendency in the Buddhist discourses, maybe not the very favorable tendency, and that is to try to always draw a contrast between the Buddha's assembly of followers as being very restrained, disciplined, self-controlled, and then always depicting the other communities of ascetics and wanderers as just utterly uncontrolled, reckless, heedless in their behavior. And so they're frequently described as engaging, when they have their assemblies, as engaging loudly and noisily in these topics of pointless talk. And for the topics themselves, we have to turn back to Sutta number 76, paragraph 4. I'll get the page. 618. Okay, they're talking about, well, from, I have to say, from my own experience with Buddhist monks, not so unusual for religious people to be talking these things when they sit around with a lot of time on their hands, talking about kings. In those days, talking about kings. Nowadays, they might be talking about presidential elections, talking about robbers, crimes that take place that you can read about in the newspapers, talking about ministers, what this minister is doing, that minister. In other words, talk about politics, about armies, whose army is more powerful, and this army is more powerful than that army. What are the new weapons that this army has? What kind of weapons that army is now developing? Talking about different dangers. It's not quite clear about this. Battles, different war battles that have taken place. Talking about food, what kind of food is more delicious? Whose cooking is more delicious than whose? If they're going an alms round, where you can go to get good food, what places to avoid, if one wants to avoid simple food, comparing different drinks, different clothing, fashions, beds, garlands, perfumes, relatives, vehicles. In those days? Villages, towns, cities, maybe comparing notes to different places they visited, the exciting, interesting places to see in this town, this city, different countries, in this sense, the different regions or districts, talking about women, wandering ascetics, heroes, streets, wells, yeah, I just want to see what the well, Kumbhatana, that's a pool. Okay, Pulba. Okay, talk about the dead, those who have passed away. Then it's called trifles. It's just in the Pali, nanatakatanga. Just talk about miscellaneous topics, different topics. Then the origin of the world, or speculations about the world. This is speculative cosmology. Talk about the sea, speculations about the sea, how the sea originated, And then what's given here is whether things are so or are not so. Iti bhava, iti bhava, abhava kattam. Again, it seems to be just a phrase catching different types of various talk, miscellaneous talk. Okay, then as they are talking, engaging in this talk, the wanderer, Sakaludai, sees the Buddha coming in the distance. And when he sees him, he quiets his own assembly down, saying that we should be quiet. Here comes the recluse Gotama. This venerable one likes quiet and commends quiet. And perhaps if he finds our assembly a quiet one, he will think to join us. And so when he says this, then the wanderers all become quiet. And so as the Blessed One, as the Buddha draws near, the wanderer Sakaludai welcomes him and greets him in a somewhat unusual way for the discourses. He says, "Let the Blessed One come, Venerable Sir." He uses the word Bhante. "Welcome to the Blessed One." He addresses the Buddha as Bhagava, Blessed One, which is the expression, the word that the Buddha's own disciples use for him. Almost exclusively used amongst the Buddha's own disciples. "It is long since the Blessed One found an opportunity to come here. Let the Blessed One be seated. This seat is ready." And it's somewhat puzzling why he should be referring to the Buddha as Blessed One, Bhagava and Bhante, Venerable Sir. Anybody have any idea why this might have been taking place? Why this expression might be used?
Well, they obviously had a history with him of some sort.
Excuse me?
They had a history with him of some sort, it seems.
Maybe, but I don't think that is the answer. Of course, the answer I have in mind is also my own conjecture.
He's trying if the Buddha had an ego to soothe it, to make him like, you're great, you're wonderful.
No, I think ordinarily they could address the Buddha as Bo Gotama, like Honorable Gotama, and that would be sufficient. Usually the Buddha, when he meets with other ascetics, they greet him in that way. My question is something of a trick question. Excuse me?
Was he still very young?
Very
young?
No. Okay, I'll have to tell you my understanding. Okay, we have to remember that the suttas were not written literature, but orally transmitted literature. And what happens is that there are stock passages that occur in different suttas, which are just repeated over and over, and sometimes you find these same passages occurring in several suttas. Now, a statement like this probably occurred in other suttas where it could have been the Buddha's own disciples or followers addressing him and welcoming him. And so, in the minds of the reciters, when they're reciting this, they become used to expressing the passage in this way. And when that passage was brought into this particular sutta, probably originally it might have been correctly modified to suit the situation, so that instead of addressing the Buddha as Blessed One, he would have been addressed as the ascet, as Master Gotama. But some later reciter would have gotten the passages mixed up because he was accustomed to recite the passage from another sutta. And so his mistake, maybe he taught that mistaken recitation to his students, they taught it to their students, and the mistake is sort of like a mutation that catches on and becomes successful, that propagates itself, and it would have driven the original reading out of circulation in the Pali tradition. But fortunately, according to the research of my friend Venerable Nalayo here, in the Chinese version of the sutta that's been preserved in Chinese, when the wanderer Sakaludai addresses the Buddha, he doesn't address him as Blessed One, but he uses what address, Venerable Nalayo? He uses the address that's the equivalent of Bo Gotama, of Master Gotama.
So,
it seems the use of Samana Gotama as an address is unusual. Probably in a footnote. Okay, so anyway, he invites the Buddha to a seat, the Buddha sits down, and then the Buddha asks him, what is the subject of what was the subject of the discussion that you were having? And again, this is a stock phrase, what was your discussion that was interrupted? But in this version, Udayi is a little embarrassed to report what was the subject of the discussion. So he says, we'll tell you about it later. But now he brings up something else that has been happening. And that is, he's saying that in recent days, that ascetics and Brahmins of various sects have been gathering together and sitting together in the debating hall, and this topic has arisen, that it is a gain for the people of Anga and Magadha, it is a great gain for them, that ascetics and Brahmins, very famous ones, have come to spend the reins at Rajagaha. You remember that the reins, this is the period of 3 months, roughly from sometime in July to sometime in October, when the monsoon arrives in India. And during this period, the ascetics and wanderers don't travel about, but they remain in a fixed residence. And it so happened that at this time, according to the sutta, a number of famous teachers had all come and gathered to spend the reins at Rajagaha, in different places at Rajagaha. And here he refers to what are called the six famous teachers of this period. It seems almost like an astounding coincidence that they should all come to spend the reins at Rajagaha at exactly the same time. Almost as though that this early part of the discourse is kind of setting the stage for what is to follow, and providing an opportunity to present an unfavorable comparison of the other teachers with the Buddha. And so he mentions these six famous teachers, the rivals of the Buddha. I'll come to them and their teachings in a moment, but he mentions Purana Kassapa, Makkali Gosala, Achita Kesa Kambala, Pakuta Kachayana Sanjaya Belati Puta and the Ganta Nataputa. Each one is said to be the head of an order, that is, of a Sangha. Each one is the head of a group, a company of followers. Each is a teacher of a group. And each is called the famous founder of a sect, regarded by many as a holy person, as a saint. The Pali or Sanskrit word here is sadhu, a word which is still used in India today for a holy man. And along with these six rival teachers, there is also the Samana Gotama, who is described in exactly the same terms. And after bringing in the six ascetics, mentioning them all, the question arises amongst those who are holding the discussion, who of these is honored, respected, revered, and venerated by his disciples? And which one, in the case of which one, has disciples who truly live in dependence upon him? That is, who truly look to him for guidance. And then amongst all of the ascetics and Brahmins who are holding this discussion, each one of the famous teachers has their own advocates, their own partisans, those who regard them as, each one has some followers who regard him as someone special. Okay, the first one who's praised is Purana Kasapa. Purana Kasapa, according to the Digha Nikaya, the Samanyapala Sutta of the Digha Nikaya, taught a doctrine which comes to be known as, in Pali, as Akiryavada. We might translate this or explain it as the doctrine of the inefficacy of actions. And we find this doctrine proposed or propounded or described in Sutta number 76. In paragraph 10, this is on page 620. For those who don't have the book, I'll just read it out in part. It's a very bizarre doctrine the way it's presented in the Buddhist text. When one person acts or makes others act, when one mutilates or makes others mutilate, when one tortures or makes others inflict torture, when one inflicts sorrow or makes others inflict sorrow, and so on. When one kills living beings, takes what is not given, breaks into houses, plunders wealth, commits burglary, seduces another's wife, utters falsehood, one commits no evil. Even if one were to go along this earth, killing many living beings, making them into one heap of flesh, one would not commit any evil and would not be subject to any of the consequences of evil. And if one were to go around giving gifts, making offerings, benefiting others, because of this there would be no merit and no result of merit. by giving, by self-control, by restraint, by speaking truth, there is no merit and no result of merit. This is the doctrine of Akiryavada, the inefficacy of action. And for this, expounding this doctrine, according to the Buddhist texts, because we have to remember that we're always getting these doctrines of the rival teachers. I can say from an unbiased perspective. I know as Buddhists we're supposed to say the Buddhist texts are infallible, represent the views of others infallibly. In this case, I don't really think that's possible. It's possible to say that. Because it seems very difficult to believe that if anybody were expounding a doctrine like that, others would regard him as worthy of respect and veneration and treat that person as a saint. But this is the way the view is presented in the Buddhist suttas. And so this person, for propounding a doctrine like that, he's regarded by many as a saint. Okay, but some say that this Purana Kasapa is not honored, respected, revered, and venerated by his disciples, nor do his disciples live in dependence on him, honoring and respecting him. And they cite a case that once Purana Kasapa was teaching his doctrine to an assembly of several hundred followers, and then one of his disciples started making a commotion. Apparently, somebody was asking Purana Kasapa a question, and one of the disciples stood up and said, "Don't ask Purana that question. He doesn't know the answer. I know the answer. Ask me the question. I'll answer it for you." And when he said that, then Purana Kasapa got upset. And again, this is almost like a lampooning of the rival teacher. He gets up, Purana Kasapa, waves his arm in the air, wails and says, "Be quiet, don't make any noise. They're not asking you, they're asking me. I'll answer them." And then the speaker says that many of his disciples refuted his doctrine and left him. And then they describe the way they refute his doctrine. Again, this is a stock passage that comes very often in the text. And one could say that if Purana Kasapa taught a doctrine that is as absurd as that which the text ascribed to him, it's no wonder that there would be disciples who would leave him and that would refute his teaching. Anyway, so on the basis of the fact that some of his disciples showed him disrespect by standing up while he was lecturing and saying that you should ask questions to me, not to him, other disciples tried to refute his doctrine and left him. On that basis, the speaker says, Purana Kasapa is not honored, respected, revered, and venerated by his disciples, and his disciples don't really live in dependence on him and seek his guidance. And so he is scorned or ridiculed or rejected by the scorn, the rejection, the ridicule shown to his teaching. Okay, then the same thing, again, the stock passage is said about Makkali Gosala. Makkali Gosala is known as the founder of a school of thought called the Ajivakas. This school of thought continued in India actually for quite a long time, continued perhaps down to about the 15th century. It had followers, monasteries in India, I think as late as the 12th century, 15th century. 12th century. Okay, we find Makkali Gosala's view also stated in Sutta number 76. It's also called by another name. The Makkali Gosala's view is stated in Sutta number 76 in paragraph 13. This view is called Niyatiwada, which means the doctrine of predestination or fate. You call it fatalism or hard determinism, strict determinism. And it's also called Ahetukavada, which means the doctrine of non-causality. And the reason why it's called the doctrine of non-causality is clear from the statement of the doctrine itself. This is the way it's stated on page 621. This is Sutta number 76, paragraph 13. There is no cause or condition for the defilement of beings. Beings are defiled without cause or condition. And there is no cause or condition for the purification of beings. Beings are purified without cause or condition. There is no power, no energy, no manly strength, no manly endurance. All beings, all living things, all creatures, all souls are without mastery, power, and energy. They are molded by destiny, circumstance, and nature, and they experience pleasure and pain in the six classes. That is, Makkali Gosala held that there were like six classes of rebirth. And he said that beings take rebirth into these different classes, not as a result of their own volitional deeds, the way the Buddha taught, but through the working of niyati, which means fate or destiny. And so they have no power or energy to change their destiny. Every being has its own destiny, its own fate. And it just has to follow its own destiny. And one can't do anything to change one's destiny. And in the version of his doctrine that comes down in the Digha Nikaya, this view is also can be described as purification through samsara. Because what he holds is that all beings are naturally purified as they wander on in samsara. Like there's not a matter of each one making their own effort to purify themselves and gain liberation from samsara. But just as they go on, driven from life to life, sometimes in good states, sometimes in bad states, they are naturally being purified until in the end, again through the working of destiny, they gain liberation. In the Digha Nikaya version, which in the Majjhima Nikaya version is described to another teacher, it's compared to a ball of string. When you throw the ball of string, the string just goes unwinding, unrolling, unrolling, till eventually it completely unwinds. And so that is like the nature of samsara. We just go on rolling and rolling from life to life till eventually we get unwound, liberated. And so it doesn't matter whether one is foolish, wise, whether one makes a determined effort to practice, to observe precepts, practice meditation, develop wisdom, or one just indulges oneself, enjoys oneself. It doesn't matter, because it's just destiny will eventually lead one to liberation. Then the next teacher is Ajita Kesakambali. Ajita Kesakambali. He taught a doctrine that we would today describe as pretty much strict materialism. It's called in Pali Natikavada, which we would translate as nihilism, philosophical nihilism. And his doctrine we find expounded again in Sutta number 76. On page 619, this is Sutta number 76, paragraph 7. Again, I'll just take the highlights from this view. There is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. What this means is that there's really no special virtue in giving or in making offerings to others or in sacrificing one's own good for the good of others. There's no results of good and bad deeds. There's no rebirth into this world, no rebirth into any other world, no point in serving one's mother and father. There are no beings reborn spontaneously. And there are no good and virtuous ascetics and Brahmins who have realized through any kind of higher wisdom the nature of this world. And here comes the materialist doctrine. A person, a living being, consists only of the four great elements. So what we call the mind, according to his view, what we call the mind or consciousness is just a kind of byproduct of material processes. It said that just as, I think when, the way it's stated in the commentary is, when you mix together certain fruit juices and, is it hops? You get the alcoholic, the intoxicating property, the alcohol develops out of the chemical reactions. And so that intoxicating quality of the drink is just a byproduct of the chemical composition of the drink. And so, analogously, consciousness, mind, is just a byproduct of the physical processes. And so when a person dies, this is in his view, each of the four great elements returns to the great mass of inanimate element. The earth in the body returns to the impersonal earth element. The water in the body returns to the universal cosmic water element, and so on. The sense faculties just dissolve into space, and men carry the body away to the funeral grounds. And so people will praise him for his good deeds, but nothing more than that will survive the death of the body. And so this person, he says that giving is a doctrine of fools. And if anyone asserts that there is some kind of merit in giving, precepts and so on, that's just empty nonsense. The fools and the wise people are alike cut off and annihilated at death. And when the body breaks up at death, they're cut off, annihilated, and they don't exist after death.
Even if they held that to be true, wouldn't there be benefit for pleasant abidings in the here and now? Giving and... supporting one's mother and father and all that sort of stuff?
Probably so, and... as that sutta number 76 points out, that they were living ascetic lives, not indulging and enjoying themselves. So a person comes along and refutes them, saying, if you hold this doctrine, why are you living an ascetic life? Your lifestyle is incompatible with your doctrine. Okay, the next view is the view of Pakuta Kachayana. And he holds to a kind of also, it's, I don't know a very neat Pali expression for it, but it's a kind of atomism. Again, it's a peculiar view. We find this expressed in Sutta number 76. In paragraph 16. He says that there are these seven bodies, and these really mean seven types of elements, that are unmade, not brought forth, uncreated, without a creator, barren, standing like mountain peaks, standing like pillars. They do not move, change, or obstruct each other. None is able to arouse pleasure or pain, or both pleasure and pain in another. What are the seven? The earth body, the water body, the fire body, the air body, pleasure, pain, and the soul as the seventh. So these are considered like seven, almost like seven elements, which are forever existing, and they come together in combinations, and it's from their combinations that all of the apparent change, diversity, shifting scenarios of phenomena in the world take place. But the underlying elements, the basic constituting forces, these are uncreated, eternal, and are always remaining the same, unchanging in their own nature. And so certain moral consequences follow from this position for Pakuta. He says, there is no killer, no hearer, no speaker, no cognizer, no one who communicates anything. Please, I hope I'm not going to convert anybody to his doctrine tonight. Even those who cut off someone's head with a sharp sword do not deprive anyone of life, because the soul is everlasting, and it's just, somehow it's just contingently connected to the material elements of the body. So what happens when somebody cuts off the head of somebody else? The sword merely passes through the space between the seven bodies. So the head falls off, the some of the elements are disconnected from the other elements. The soul itself remains, it's everlasting, so the soul is not destroyed. And so nobody really kills anybody, nobody dies. Nobody dies, therefore nobody kills anybody. And then this long, strange cosmology, which here in the Majjhima Nikaya it's ascribed, it's connected to the doctrine of the seven bodies. But in the Digha Nikaya, this long cosmology is ascribed to Makkali Gosala and connected to the doctrine of Niyativada. And I think that's correct, the Digha Nikaya version. Of course, there's other evidence for the doctrine of the Ajivikas, which substantiates that. And here, at the very end of paragraph 16, we have the simile of the string. We have, again, the round of rebirths, that is, samsara, is limited. There is no shortening it or extending it, no increasing it or decreasing it. Just as a ball of string, when thrown, goes only as far as the string unwinds, so too, by running and wandering through the round of rebirths, fools and wise both will make an end to suffering. Okay, the next teacher is Sanjaya Bailatiputta. Okay, Sanjaya Bailatiputta was a teacher of a doctrine that we would call in English skepticism. In fact, he didn't really have a very clear doctrine at all. In the Pali, okay, in Sutta number 76, we have his way of teaching his disciples. We have this in on page 625, paragraph 30. It said that the teacher is dull and confused, and when he is asked a particular question, he engages in verbal wriggling or eel wriggling. Instead of giving a straightforward answer, he says, "I don't say it is like this, I don't say it is like that, I don't say it is otherwise, I don't say it is not so, I don't say it is not so." In a way, I think this way of explaining his position might be bordering on caricature. But probably Sanjaya was a skeptic who held that it's not possible for mere human beings to achieve definite, certain knowledge about the great philosophical questions that trouble human beings. And so in the Buddhist texts we have these major philosophical questions come down, like whether the world is eternal or not eternal, infinite or finite, whether the soul is the same as the body, different from the body, whether the enlightened person exists after death, does not exist after death. So when Sanjaya was asked these questions, he would never give a definite answer. But he would always answer in this way, the way, "I don't say it is this, I don't say it is that way." And the Buddhist texts take this to be an indication that he's dull and confused. But he might actually have been quite a sophisticated thinker who would hold that you could develop a line of reasoning which would show that the world is eternal. But equally, one could develop, with equal validity, one could develop a line of reasoning that will show that the world is not eternal. And so just by using reason as one's method for answering these questions, one arrives at two contradictory positions. And so for Sanjaya, this might have been evidence that human reason is not able to solve these problems, and that they're just beyond the scope of the human mind.
What I always find confusing about that is the Buddha also doesn't answer those questions.
Yeah, but the Buddha says that he doesn't answer them. He doesn't say, I don't say it is like this, I don't say it is like that, in that sort of evasive way. But he says that these questions, I don't answer. He gives a reason why he doesn't answer these questions. These questions don't pertain to the essence of the spiritual life. Whether it is this way or that way, still there is birth, old age, sickness, and death, for which I teach the path to the liberation right here and now. Okay, the fifth teacher, or actually, the sixth teacher in the list is Nigantha Nataputta, who is also known to historians of religion as Mahavira, the founder of Jainism. I won't go into his teachings, since to go into it, one would have to go into the rather complex teachings of Jainism, which, well, Jainism has still survived all the way down to the present day. And I should actually correct myself and say Nigantha Nataputta was not the founder of Jainism, since it seems that Jainism went back long before the time of the Buddha. But Nigantha Nataputta was the best known historical teacher in the evolution or historical development of Jainism. Okay, so each of these teachers, the same type of treatment is given to the treatment of Purana Kassapa. Each one is said to have followers who treat him with disrespect and disregard, and who claim that they can refute his teaching, and who walk out on him and leave him. And now they come to the recluse Gotama. And of course, since we're getting this presented from the Buddhist texts, what they report about the Buddha, the way the others speak about the Buddha, is going to be exclusively favorable. At least it's the way it's come down in the Pali version. But my friend Van Venable Analio has shown a little dissonant note in the Chinese version. Okay. The recluse Gotama is praised in the same way, the head of the Sangha and so on, honored and respected by his followers. And then it said that once he was teaching his Dhamma to an assembly of several hundred followers, and there a certain disciple of his cleared his throat. But in the Chinese version it said that a disciple of his was sleeping and snoring. So it seems in that transmission of the text, not all of the members of the audience found his talk so entrancing, so stimulating, and gripping that they were attending to it with unbroken attention.
The Chinese texts that you keep referring to, what are they translated from?
Would have been translated from?
From a Prakrit, probably belonging to the Gandhari Prakrit.
Prakrit is a name for different Indian languages. Pali is also Prakrit. And we're pretty sure that Mahima Atma was translated from a Prakrit, and there are some scholars who say it was Gandhari.
Is that so? But not from Sanskrit?
Definitely not from Sanskrit.
Oh, really?
They, you know, in certain ways how they have transliterated proper names, and these Japanese scholars, they figure out like what it was, and it's probably none of the Agmas from a pure Sanskrit for sure. And Dharma, Dhammaguptaka Dirga Agma and Ekota Agma for sure, but Madhyama Agma also quite probably from Gandhari Prakrit. So a language of the same family that also the language the Buddha spoke belongs to, and also the same family where Pali belongs to.
Okay, so coming back now to the text, when this disciple clears his throat, then one of his fellow monks nudges him with his knee and asks him to be quiet and make no noise. This is proof to show how they're also intent upon listening to the Buddha give his discourse. And then it says, when the recluse Gotama is teaching the Dhamma to an assembly of several hundred followers, on that occasion there is no sound of his disciples coughing or clearing their throats. So that contradicts what was just said in the previous sentence, that there is a sound, occasion, at least on one occasion, of a disciple clearing his throat. For then that large assembly is listening, expecting to hear the Dhamma. And then it gives a very interesting simile that we don't see it in this country, but at a crossroads, a man is pressing out pure honey from a honeycomb, and a group of people are surrounding him and looking and watching, waiting for the honey to come out from the honeycomb and to pour into the container. I guess they might use a container made out of goat skin or something to contain the honey. And so in the same way, the way everybody is looking very intent, waiting for the honey to come pouring out from the honeycomb, so when the Buddha is teaching to an assembly, everybody is listening intent to follow, intent on his discourse, following each word very keenly. And then the text goes on to say that some of the disciples, again, this is a little bit revealing that things aren't quite the way they should be on the surface. Things aren't quite the way they're presented to be on the surface. Even those disciples of his who fall out with their companions in the holy life, that is, who fall out with their fellow monks and abandon the training to return to the low life, that is, they give up the robes, give up the life of monks and become lay followers, even they continue to praise the Buddha, that's the Master, and the Dhamma and the Sangha, and they blame themselves instead, saying that we were unlucky with little merit, for even though we went forth into homelessness, we were unable to live the holy life for the rest of our lives. But I have to say, this is very true today, when there are, in Buddhist countries, many men are ordained as Buddhist monks, and of those who get ordained when they're young, a large number will disrobe after a certain number of years. And when they disrobe, they always think, not that the fault is with the Buddha's teaching, but they say, we don't have enough merit, we don't have good enough accumulations from previous lives, we're not fortunate enough, and so we could not continue to live as monks. And so the text goes on that those who give up the monastic life become monastery attendants, or they become lay followers who undertake and observe the five precepts. And in this way, the ascetic Gotama is honored, respected, revered, and venerated by his disciples, and his disciples live in dependence on him, honoring and respecting him. Okay, I will stop the discussion at this point, then ask if there's any questions, any comments. Maybe Venerable Anālio might have some illuminating comments.
I have actually two things concerning Makkali Gosala and concerning Sangha. The first thing of Makkali Gosala, when I read the Sanyaka Sutta, I checked with the views attributed in the different version of Samanya Pala Sutta.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is that none of the other sources, Chinese, Sanskrit, Tibetan, attributes this samsara suddhi to Makkali, this idea of samsara purification.
Oh, is that so?
And there's one, I think it's Ekotra Agama, that agrees actually with the Sanyaka Sutta on attributing this theory to Pagodaka China.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I also, it is difficult to come to a clear conclusion, but if we really look at it, he says, Nati hetu, nati paccaya sattanam visuddhiya. There's no cause, there's no reason for the visuddhi, for the purification of beings.
Mm.
If I say that there is no cause, it would seem to me contradictory afterwards to say, but there is a cause, just by being reborn in samsara. Because if I say beings are automatically being purified through a certain amount of rebirth in samsara, then I'm actually proposing some sort of cause for their visuddhi.
I wouldn't see that as contradictory. Because I think what is denied by a Hetuka doctrine is that it's human effort, human exertion, human will that can serve as the cause for purification or defilement. But he does make... Yeah. In the position as clearly Makkali Gosala's, he does say that all souls, all beings, living things, all creatures are molded by destiny, circumstance, and nature. So he does definitely ascribe causal power to destiny, circumstance, and nature. On page 621. I think it's Niyati, Sangati, Sabhava, is it?
Niyati, Sangati, Bhava, Parinata. And the Samsara Suti theory has a lot of sevens in it.
Yeah.
And Pagodaka Chaya theory has a lot of sevens.
Yeah, that is, yeah.
It's actually quite good.
Yeah.
And Franke, in his translation of Liganika, he has noticed that the first part of Makkali's theory, which is the one that we also have in Sanyaka Sutta, has a different type of pali than the second part. In the second part, you get a lot of Makkalisms, nominative in A and this kind of thing. So without even knowing of the other versions, he already thought that this must be from two different sources.
Who is this?
Franke.
Oh, I see, yeah.
Franke, yes. Liganika. So I mean, the point you're making is a good point. Mm. I still think that the Sanyaka Sutta's presentation of...
There might be so, yeah.
There might be something to it.
Mm-hmm.
And the other point was about Sanjaya, because I don't remember which, but some sources actually identify him with the teacher of Sariputta Moggallana. The Pali tradition makes a difference between them, but...
Mm.
In other sources they do, and that answers a little bit, I think, his question also.
Mm.
Because if he was really a skeptic, and I think I agree with your presentation, this is how I would see him. And now Sariputta Moggallana, they were already like disenchanted with all these different views.
Yeah.
So they wrote Sanjaya. But then when this Yidamahetu Parbhava this significant statement that the Buddha teaches there is some cause.
Yeah.
That sparks of Sai Buddhism.
Yeah.
This is the way.
Yeah.
So that if I see Sanjaya or Sai Buddha Moggallana as students of Sanjaya, and then they disregard all these different views, but causality is something that needs to be affirmed.
Yeah.
And this is exactly the difference between Sanjaya and the Buddha.
Yeah.
Not only in regard to all these different viewpoints, but the Buddha affirms something. It affirms causality.
Yeah.
Or teaches Samapada, Dharma. Sanjaya would not affirm that.
Yeah.
But again, I cannot be sure, but in that way it makes more sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, Sariputta and Moggallana, according to the Pali sources, before they became followers of the Buddha, they were wandering ascetics, seeking a path to liberation. And then they became disciples of a teacher whose name is Sanjaya, but that teacher is not explicitly identified with the Sanjaya Velatiputta. But it's quite possible, as Venerable Nalio said, that actually that teacher was Sanjaya Velatiputta. And particularly Sariputta, being an intellectual type, might have been attracted to him because his reasoning, he might have had very strong reasoning powers. And so his reasoning powers might have appealed to Sariputta. But he would have still felt spiritually unsatisfied, that he didn't yet really find the way to liberation. Any more questions?
It seems to me that the doctrine of karma that the Buddha teaches is formulated to contrast strongly with this whole group of teachers.
That is so. The one thing that continually strikes me is very strange. Is it really possible that the doctrine of karma could not have been fairly widespread in some form during the time of the Buddha? And could these teachers really have been so popular and had such a strong influence if they so blatantly denied and ridiculed the doctrine of karma? Are we getting a truly accurate presentation of their teaching? That is.
Well, maybe karma was seen as the orthodoxy view of the Brahmins. So maybe there was a large number of people who. It's a franchise for Brahminism.
Yeah.
And sort of threw karma out with everything else, with the ritualism, with the hierarchies.
Yeah, that is possible. But could teachers who taught such, I call it, morally outrageous doctrines have got one followings and become regarded by people as saintly, wise, venerables? Does it seem credible?
It's dependent on how immoral they led their lives.
Isn't it all possible that some of these teachers, while they may have existed, that their inclusion is strictly used to highlight the Buddhist teachings?
I think definitely so. The question is to what extent their views are being accurately portrayed in the text. In the case of several of them, we have no way to tell.
They don't exist anywhere else other than.
Yeah, there's no independent sources on their teaching with which to compare what we see in the Pali texts.
The Jaina sources have some material on the Purana Makkali.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be pretty similar to the Pali representation. And I think in some class talk you brought up this story about this mason, or what this person was called, this kind of sect group, and they killed some, just without any reason killed some people.
Charles Mason, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's about as absurd his theory as these people. He also had followers.
He had followers, yeah.
Yes, I think
Alistair Crowley had many followers, and he engaged all sorts of
I just like to say that I think it's very plausible that these people would have been influential and highly regarded because their intellectual descendants are influential and highly regarded.
Their intellectual descendants are what?
We have, in our Western culture today, relativism has replaced any form of belief in objective values or truth. We have lawyers arguing the case of Leopold and Lowe that nobody is responsible for the most outrageous behavior because of determinism. And we build prisons without bars or any of all the comforts because we don't believe that people are responsible.
Say nothing of materialism.
Skepticism's alive and well on the internet.
Okay, I think we have to end for tonight. Okay, we will continue next week. Next week we will come more directly to the Buddha's own teaching. Okay, we end by sharing the merits. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mantarang etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe satta anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.